Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by longtime friend, Rich Fetke. Rich is the co-founder of RealWealth.com, a real estate investing platform that's helped over 70,000 members build real wealth through smart passive investing. He's the best-selling author of The Wise Investor, Extreme Success, and his new book, Scaling Smart. Rich brings decades of coaching, investing, and leadership experience to help people design lives of freedom. A former ESPN X Games competitor, master certified business coach, he's been featured in Wall Street Journal, CNN, and Entrepreneur. This is his second time on our show, and I'm super excited for this. And Rich and I aren't super close, but I've known him for over 12 years now, and he's always been an amazing, supportive, and genuine person. So whether you're scaling a business or investing in turnkey rentals, I've asked Rich to join us here today to share his story and insights into the mindset, systems, and connections to thrive, how to build wealth with purpose. So Rich, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you doing?
Doing great. Honored to be a second time guest. That's pretty awesome.
Right? Hey, anything we're doing once is we're doing twice. So
yeah, good to be here. Good to be here.
So for those that don't know your origin story, how did you get into real estate? Is this something your parents were into and you just are carrying the torch, the family torch forward?
That would be nice. But I mean, my parents were always scrappy in the sense of they bought a small house, they fixed it up, they put a lot of sweat equity into it, and then got a nicer house and kept moving up that way. We always lived in pretty nice homes, but they never invested in real estate. And I always thought someday I'd be a real estate investor. I actually wrote my obituary back in the personal development workshop. And in that obituary, I wrote something about Rich Fetke dies at 108 years old and a whole bunch of things. And I wrote, he was a real estate investor, a businessman, things like that. But I never thought I could invest soon enough. I thought I had to have a lot of money. And so I put it off. I just kept putting it off, which now we know that you don't have to have a ton of money to invest in real estate, that you can get started a lot sooner than you would think. But for me, it was actually desperation. It was my wife who got us into real estate investing, because we did buy a home after we got married, the year we got married. And that home was a little more than we could afford. It was a lot more than we could afford. It was a 4,000 square foot house in the San Francisco Bay Area. So what we did is we turned the lower level into two different units. They had their own entrances. So we house hacked back then, which there wasn't even that term. And so we had tenants downstairs, and that's how we became accidental landlords. So all that was great. We had two tenants and we were real estate investors in a way. But then I was a coach and a speaker, and I had just signed a book deal with Simon & Schuster. So everything in my life felt like it was just amazing. I was living the dream, going great financially. And then I was diagnosed with melanoma, which is the most advanced form of skin cancer. Wow. And so I had a couple surgeries to remove that. And the doctors said I needed to get a scan to make sure it hadn't metastasized and spread in somewhere else. And they saw four masses on my liver. And so after multiple tests, I met with an oncologist, and he's the one who said, yeah, it looks like it's spread to your liver. And if it's melanoma, you probably have 6 months to live.
Wow.
So it absolutely rocked our world. We had young daughters and didn't really know what to do, and especially Kathy. Luckily, it was a misdiagnosis that was hemangiomas, just clusters of blood vessels that showed up, and a PET scan gave me the cancer-free diagnosis.
Oh, man.
But in that time waiting for test to test, it was a scary time. And that's when Kathy said, what am I going to do? She was a stay-at-home mom at the time. She said, what am I going to do if I die? So she's the one that she had like a kind of a radio show as a hobby. And she was paying for airtime in San Francisco. And it was her dream. She had a communications degree. And so she had this show, and it was mostly focused on personal development, coaching. And she started to interview people about how they created wealth. And she had a real estate investor on, and he was also a mortgage broker. So she came home excited about that and said, this is what I can do. Then got that positive diagnosis that everything was okay, luckily. But that was a spark where she said, let's start investing. And she became a mortgage broker. That led her to helping people get loans for investment properties. And then after a bunch of that's when she started helping people buy investment properties. And that was the birth of our company that we later called Real Wealth. It was Real Wealth Network back then. Now it's just called Real Wealth. And so what we do is we help people buy investment properties around the country, 1 to 4 unit rental properties in cash flowing markets, appreciating markets, where they can put together a portfolio of rental properties to help them create some financial freedom. That's the bottom line of it.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's incredibly powerful. I think a lot of people, I know for myself, I had a wake up call during COVID where I was like, you might have life insurance. That's great. But what do you do? What do you do? You know what I mean? When you can't go to work per se, what do you do when the whole world shuts down? And that was a real kind of, I think it's maybe for you, it was the melanoma, but the false diagnosis. And so what a wake up call that was, and especially with kids. So
it was crazy. So
she did this call with this mortgage broker and got inspired, and the pearly gates opened and it was sunshine and rainbows and money just started
that would be really
into
nice.
Your lives. And was that how it went? No,
it went like that for a few years until 2008. And then 2008, we were over leveraged. We were not walking the talk. We were telling people to invest in cash flowing markets where it all makes sense. But we had held on to two of our California properties and had them as rentals that were negative cash flow. And then when 2008 hit and things went south and we couldn't get financing for other properties, and it hit us hard. So we had to do some short sales and some foreclosures and lost some properties. And that really set us back. But it also taught us some really powerful lessons about every property needs to make sense from the day you buy it. You can't bet on appreciation. You got to at least have some cash flow. And so we carried that over to our own portfolio and to all the members in our network. And so we have investment counselors. We help people invest the smart way, the wise way, and never looking back.
So you say every property needs to make sense the day you buy it. That means it has to be a profitable deal when you close on it.
Exactly. You got to look at the numbers and say, how much is it going to cost in total expenses from principal, interest, taxes, insurance, from your property management fee, which is usually about 8 to 10% of your rent. If you want to invest out of state, which is what we help people do, it's what we do. It just doesn't make sense to invest in California in these high price markets. Also not very landlord friendly here in California, New York, whatever. Yeah. All those lessons we've carried over, and we share that with our members of our network.
So what were some of the biggest, or I should ask, what are some of the biggest challenges people face that you see your members struggle with?
Oh, let's see. I'll go with two answers on this. One is people who try to do it on their own, people who try to look for a market and choose the right market. And then once they find a market, often it's not the right one. And if it is the right one, sometimes it's finding the right team to, how are you going to find these properties? And a lot of times people just go to a real estate agent who doesn't own rental properties, doesn't know how that all works. And the real estate agent just wants to sell them a house. And so they'll just show them a house. Often it'll be overpriced. They don't know how to work the numbers. And then they'll try to manage it on their own from afar, which can be a huge mistake. And so it's like finding local proper property management. So that's what I see people having a hard time with when they don't go through Real Wealth. And that's the stories, people that come to Real Wealth to join. It's free to join Real Wealth, always has been. And so the people who join Real Wealth and they tell us those stories, it just makes me like, oh, I wish I could have got to them before they went through that. But the biggest challenge that people have investing through us, where we've vetted property teams, we've vetted markets, we've vetted the property management. And so we know what's good, what's quality. And a lot of our property teams and brokers have been with us for over 10 years. So we trust them. We know them. They're the boots on the ground. I would say the biggest challenge that our members going through is acquiring properties at a low enough interest rate to be able to make it a cash flow property. Interest rates are fairly high compared to when we started, and especially compared to like around 2020 when they were down the 3% area. And that's the biggest challenge I see right now, that investors trying to make the numbers work if they can't get that good interest rate. Luckily, some of our property teams have bought down the rate for their interest for their properties. So they can offer something at more like 3.5% financing. But what they do is they just take some of their profits, they pay down the rate on the mortgage so the investor can get a better rate on that mortgage and the numbers make sense.
And keep it competitive. Yeah, that's really helpful.
Exactly.
And powerful. So what would you recommend to someone that's starting out and struggling right now? I guess go join the realwealth.com. But if someone's brand new and they're going through it and they're trying to figure out, because obviously it's a multidisciplinary thing. It's not just one. Is it just a one trick pony? I just got to connect to Real Wealth and now I'm going to get rich. Or what would you recommend to someone starting out?
It all depends on how much money they have and their timeline. To invest, you really want to have at least $50,000 to invest and to have a little bit of reserves. It's good to have at least 3 months reserves. So if the property goes vacant for 3 months, which they usually don't, but it can happen. Something goes weird or whatever, and for some reason you can't get a tenant in there, you want to have those reserves so you can cover the mortgage until you get a tenant in there. So anyway, I think it's good to have at least $50,000 to invest. So that's who we usually work with, is busy professionals that have the money to invest. They have the $50,000 plus and they want it done for them. They don't want to have to go out and search markets or buy a home and do what my parents did and force the equity into it by putting a lot of time and fixing it up and everything. But sometimes in the beginning, you have to do what Kathy and I did and buy maybe a duplex or buy a house that you can have an ADU or something and be able to live in it and then rent out part of it and do that house hack to start increasing your revenue and growing your wealth. And then when you have enough reserves and enough wealth, then, you know, to have that 50,000 plus, then I would say go the turnkey model.
Yeah, that's such a powerful concept too. That's one of the strongest principles of the richest man in Babylon. Make of thy dwelling a profitable investment. I don't know if, but richest man in Babylon, there's the
that's a great one.
Six principles. And that's such a powerful one, because where you're living can either drain you both in terms of the environment that it is, or if it's just a constant never ending fixer upper, or again, financial drain. So it's just such a powerful.
You gotta be smart.
Yeah. So now, what about with the business side of things? Obviously, running a property, in some ways, I think maybe a rental property is a good model for learning like business law and what it takes to run. Can you speak to that a little bit? Were there lessons learned, transferable? What's transferable? What wasn't? Any surprises?
A lot of transferable. You're looking at a profit and loss statement, in a sense, on your properties. You're looking at income versus expenses. Once you start to create a portfolio of several rental properties, then you're doing a full P&L report for everything. And then you're doing individual on each property, like how is each one performing? And then you can look and then you can optimize your portfolio. It's, this property is not really performing. I think I'm going to sell it. Or this market's expanding. I'm going to keep this one because I know that people are moving there, jobs are moving there, whatever it might be. So I think that's just like business. You're always looking at optimizing your business, keeping it as profitable as possible. And same thing with real estate.
I love that. Can you speak to the financial literacy component of it? What are some of the critical components that most people are probably weak in that they shouldn't be?
Interesting, or weak in and don't have to be, is the bookkeeping part, is keeping everything on track. It's a simple investment. Real estate is a slow moving investment, which can be really nice, where like the stock market, which we invest in too, as a couple and married couple, but it can be very volatile. You can see it drop rapidly. Your stocks can vaporize. A company can go chapter 11 and you lose everything. But with real estate, it's like people want a place to live, and real estate does not drop very fast. And especially nowadays where there's a shortage of real estate in the US. So that's why it's in such demand. That's why prices haven't dropped. That's why real estate sales are still happening. Even no matter what happens with the stock market or the economy, real estate usually holds pretty strong.
So again, coming back to this in terms of learning how to run a business through real estate, and that you talk about having a P&L, what sort of, is it just learning to read a profit and loss? Like, where do people typically not paying attention that they should? Is it just have the bookkeeping done and hop on a call with your bookkeeper, or?
Oh yeah. Having a good bookkeeper who's either, you have to do it well and keep everything organized in that. And because you're tracking got to make sure your insurance is paid. You got to make sure that your property taxes are paid. A lot of those times those can be escrowed in your mortgage and it's all covered in there. But sometimes if you're buying all cash, then you're going to be making those insurance payments and your property tax payments. So you just have to make sure that everything's on track and organized and that you don't miss payments. You don't get those extra fees and all that. And then also you're basically, with the turnkey model, you're mostly managing your property manager. So just like in business, you're managing a team. You got a team of people who are experts at what they do. And so having an expert bookkeeper who can do all that well, having an expert licensed property manager who knows how to find the right tenant, vet the right tenant, evict the tenant if needed, doing the collections, the maintenance, all that stuff. So you want that person that you're, and so you're managing that property manager. And once you get to a portfolio of say 10 investment properties, it's can be a beautiful thing because one, your tenants are paying your mortgage down over time. It's a hedge against inflation because you got these locked in mortgage rates. And no matter what happens with inflation over time, those mortgage rates stay the same. Don't get a variable rate mortgage, just get a fixed mortgage. And these 30-year fixed mortgages are amazing. So it's to be able to lock in a payment for 30 years on an investment property, and that rent is slowly going to go up with inflation, but that mortgage payment is not going to go up with inflation. So it's a pretty magical investment where, especially like you go to a bank and you said, hey, I want to invest in anything. Will you pay for 80% of it? And I'm going to keep all the gain. And I get all the tax write-offs. Now you can't do that with anything except for real estate.
Yeah, so you can't go, hey, I want to put $100,000 on this stock. I feel good about it. I'll put $10,000, $20,000 down.
You just can't do it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's really true. Where do you see the future of things going? What's on your horizon over the next 5-10 years? There's a lot happening geopolitically, a lot happening with technology. How's that going to impact housing and even doing business?
Housing, I think all that doesn't have a huge effect on housing and costs and all that. It's like, if you look at it over time, it pretty much holds. There's dips like 2008, but that was an anomaly with the whole financial crash and not being able, Lehman Brothers going under and people not being able to get loans and all that. And there was a huge bubble of real estate back then. It was like the prices went up so fast and it was such a frenzy back then. So I don't think we're going to see that happen as much anymore or ever again. And hopefully over time, that's why I'm saying it's so important to just make sure that your properties are cash flowing. With real estate, things are going to be changing, no doubt about it. And especially with AI, our world is going to be completely different a year from now. It's already completely different, right? But a year from now, with the rate of change with AI, it's like we've created this whole new being and we don't even know where it's going to go. But so we are really trying to stay on the cutting edge at Real Wealth as a company, and Kathy and me as investors, and really deep diving and really learning how to utilize AI and make the most of it. I think in business and in real estate, if you're behind the curve on that, it's going to really hurt you, but you can really utilize it to be more effective, to have a better business, to help more people.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're either going to be on the side of helping program the robots and the AI and the software, or you're going to be on the other side being programmed by the robots software.
It's kind of like that, how you use it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of jobs are going to be taken over by it, but still we're looking at that at Real Wealth. It's how can we utilize it and how can we better serve our investors through it? Mm. And one thing that we're seeing that AI can't do is it's not boots on the ground. It's not, it can't walk neighborhoods. It can't really see the neighborhoods. It doesn't have those personal relationships, even vetting a tenant and everything. There's a component in there, even our investment counselors, like you can go to AI and ask it for investment counseling advice and it will be pretty good, but we've tested it and often it's a very overly optimistic approach. You say, what do you think about me investing here? And I'll be, oh, that's a great idea. And here's why I think it's great. It doesn't really look for like, exactly. So right now I still see a big need for the people aspect of it.
The purple people.
The purple people. Yeah, exactly. We used to live next to a group of people called the purple people. It was like a commune.
That's very interesting. Yeah, no, I agree. I think real estate's probably going to be one of the last ones touched directly in terms of you can't fix a leak with AI right now. You can't, all this sort of stuff. I think you're going to need a ton of human involvement. I wonder what it's going to do, like you say, if there's mass layoffs, if the gap between the rich and the poor widens due to the job layoffs. How does that sort of a thing typically, what does that do to real estate? Since I didn't have this question at the start of the interview, but if you take a town that's got a major factory and then the factory closes up, what happens to the real estate in that city, in that neighborhood?
That's a really good question, because what we're always looking at before we go into a market for investment properties is what's driving the population and is it a diverse workforce? Is it all based on one industry? Like Detroit was so focused on cars and auto, And when that's they started to lose it to competition, Detroit went down and rents went down and real estate prices went down. So you can't rely on one market that is only has one employer. You have to look for a whole diverse. And so we look for markets that have like healthcare and also military and multiple things and technology. So by looking at those markets, you can protect yourself much more effectively against loss. But yeah, in some markets, it's going to be a big hit. So that's the thing. You got to research. You got to know these which markets are going to hit get hit, or at least guess at it based on all the fundamentals.
And so now let's talk about some of the kind of separate direct business advice. What are some of the habits, maybe daily, weekly, that you think are mission critical in terms of scaling smart?
In terms of scaling smart, it really depends on your position. But if you're the company owner or the company leader, CEO, president, whatever it might be, I think it's really important that daily ritual of having kind of your, I call it my CEO checklist. So it's kind of like, what do I review? I have dashboards about how we're doing. Everything's all automated, so it pulls our numbers in from QuickBooks, from our CRM HubSpot, from QuickBooks it goes into SIFT, S-Y-F-T, which is creates financial dashboards and reporting. So I think that's a very vital habit or ritual that I have. It's like keeping your thumb on the pulse, or keeping your finger on the pulse is more important. And so you can keep an eye on that to see what's working, what's not working. That's one. But I think just like anything, it's you got to go back to the beginning. It's like when it's business, like what's your business about? And you got to start with you. If you're the business owner, then you got to start with how do you want your life to look like? How do you want your life to be? We got this one life, right? So you don't want to just start a business just because you're trying to make money. You got to say, I'm going to start this business because this is how much money I want to make. This is the way I want my life to look like. And it doesn't have to be immediate, but you could say in a year or 2 years and 3 years, this is what I want my life to look like. This is the work I want to be doing. This is the type of team I want to have. I think the most important thing when it comes to scaling is to ask yourself for the sake of what? Why do I want to scale this business? Is it profitable already? And which it needs to be. So if it's profitable already, then you can look at, okay, what would scaling look like and how much do we want to scale and how fast? And not let that get in the way of those important values that you have outside of just money. Of you don't want to just create a business that's going to consume you, that's going to take you away from the people you love, that's going to take you away from taking care of your health. I think before you think about scaling a business, you first have to check in with yourself.
I love that. So in 2020, when everybody was arguing about the science of this, the science of that, my step adopted dad, the man who raised me, he worked in applied physics and geology, hard sciences. And I'd met up with this copywriter from Mindvalley. It's like a $100 million company out of Malaysia. And one of their head copywriters and I did a little work. We got connected with mutual friends and I had him on the podcast. And then we were both going to be in Hanoi at the same time. And I don't know who came up with the idea first, but I said, hey, wouldn't it be fun to just put on some sort of workshop, like just for shits and giggles, see what happens. So we managed to put something like 30 or 50 people in a room, $50 a person. And we had a one-day workshop and we recorded it all thinking maybe we'll make a course out of this or something. And then we went to do it again in Saigon, but at the last minute he had an emergency come up and he couldn't come, but we already had everything booked and people coming. So I did it. And there's one guy that came. The offer was, if you weren't happy by the lunch break, let us know. You give a full refund. It's like $30-$50, whatever, right? So, if you weren't happy by the lunch, come let us know. You get your thing back. And we provided lunch. And this guy came and he was there the whole time and he stayed past the lunch. And even afterwards, when everybody left and we were cleaning up, he stayed and was picking my wife's brain because she was running a 4-hour work week, doing six figures a year, running the type of business he couldn't even be successful in to pay his own bills for himself, trying to do it full time. And then afterwards, after all this, 40 minutes after the event, he asked me for the refund, saying, yeah, I need that for my rent money. I spent my rent money to come to this event. And I was like, what? And then I gave it to him. I was like, whatever. But then 2-3 months later, I saw him posting in a Facebook group in Saigon, in Ho Chi Minh City, this manifest your business workshop, some wooey woo-foo thing. And I was so livid. I put it together with a bunch of friends. I contacted a bunch of my friends that are professors at all these different universities around the world. And we did a preprint called The Fake Guru Solution. And I ended up spending $50,000 to hire a team of research assistants to help me go through all the academic literature on business success to say, what really moves the needle for small and medium-sized businesses. And we end up identifying 8 criticals, because what we had to do is we had to figure out, how will we measure? Okay, if we're going to figure out who's a real guru or who's not, how are we going to measure them? What are we going to measure them against? How do we know? So we had to define them. And then I found out a lot of people didn't want to be measured because there's a lot of imposter syndrome. But what I learned was the 8 critical success factors. And that's why I brought the whole thing up, was because 2 of the ones people don't talk about enough. One was self-efficacy, which is what you're talking about. Look at you. Another one was business intelligence, where all the dashboard, the input. Mm. One of my other mentors, Kim McCarthy, say delegate as much as you can. So you're calling the shots, analyzing the stats, and copywriting. This was early days of the internet. Now, I spoke to him and we said, let's update that to communicating. You know, much as you can. So you're calling the shots, analyzing the stats, and communicating. And anyways, I think that dashboard, do you have any insights? Because I remember that's one of the first things when we met and it blew my mind. So for those that don't know, I've known Rich since probably, I don't know, 2014, 2015, somewhere in there.
Yeah, right around there. Exactly.
Somewhere on there. And we did this workshop together. We were both at. And at some point, I forget who said what, but you just turned your computer around and you just shared your full business insights and dash. And I was just, my mind was blown. I felt, I couldn't believe that I was looking at one, that you had been tracking so many things and that you're just like, here, like you put your laptop in front of me. You're like, here you go. Here, just take a look. What do you think? Do you see anything? You were so open to feedback. And I was just like a kid from small town Canada. When you work with other people in that, I guess I want to ask about making that dashboard. What are some of the most critical things? There's the typical financials, profit, loss, cash flow, balance. Are those the ones that live and die by? Are there other things that you think are critical to have in a dashboard?
There's the basic business 101 that every business should be looking at, like the things you're mentioning it, right? The profit and loss, looking at the balance sheet, looking at your cash balance. That's really important to make sure that you got a runway of cash in case the business slows down. And that's the number one reason businesses go out of business, is because of cash management and the lack of cash. They run out of cash. So having that, having the reserves and or having a credit line that's there for you if you need it, I think is key. So we're always checking on that. And then some of it becomes more, then all of a sudden you got your categories too of your business, like how much are we bringing, what are the different streams of revenue? So tracking each stream of revenue or each department in your company separately, so it's almost like its own business. So like with us, we have the brokerage of referring people to property teams around the country, and we get a referral fee for doing that, and a broker to broker referral fee, just like any real estate transaction. We also have a whole sponsorship thing, because we have so many members, we have sponsors who want to pay to be on our site and be promoted. So we have a sponsorship revenue. So we are always tracking that like it's its own business. We also syndicate. So we do group investments where we'll do a residential development and have investors all join in on that and invest in that project. And then when we sell that project, all the investors share in the profits. So that's its own business. I think that's a key thing too. It's like to have these, if you're doing multiple things with multiple streams of income, treat each one like it's a separate business, and then look at your whole conglomerate of everything together and see how you're doing overall as one main business.
I love that. What lagging or leading indicators are you really trying to keep your finger on the pulse of on your dashboards? Obviously, profit loss, balance, cash flow, those are good insights, but are you tracking visits to the website, to key pages per day?
100%. So those are our lagging indicators, obviously, how much money we made and looking back on the month or where we are right now. And then leading indicators for us are like how many people come to the website, how many people converted into a free member at Real Wealth. Of those people, how many did a strategy session with an investment counselor? Of that, how many people end up reaching out to a property team to talk with them? Of that, how many people go out and visit the team and buy a property? And then how many people, I was just doing this morning, like lifetime value. How many people, how many investments does someone typically make over their lifetime with Real Wealth, and average value of that? What's it worth to the company? But then we also look at things like so many different things. Like I'm sure you're familiar with is like our advertising too. What's our cost of ad spend and what's our return on investment from the ad spend? So yeah, tracking, there's so many different things like that.
So you have a dedicated person or dedicated team just for helping consolidate all these stats? Is that?
We have a director of finance who's amazing, who keeps everything on the finance side organized and updates that SIFT dashboard I was telling you about and everything. But we have a director for each of our departments. So we have a director of marketing. We have a director of the SFR brokerage, single family rental brokerage, a director of the syndication company, director of the sponsorships. So each of them are updating their leading and lagging indicators. And we review those every week as a team.
I love that. And obviously the quality of the people you put in those roles is mission critical.
Mission critical.
So how do you make sure you put the right person in the right seat?
That is one of the biggest challenges in business. It's like, you got to go through this major interviewing process. I think you have to be very clear on your company's core values and hire to those values. When we're doing interviews, we will bring up one of our core values. Like, one of our core values is transparency. And so we'll say, tell us about a time in your career where transparency has been an issue, or it's come up as something that might be challenging, or something that you had to honor that core value. And we'll just sit back and listen to their story. And then we'll say, okay, another one of our core values is accountability. How are you with accountability? And how do you like to be held accountable? Do you like to hold other people accountable? So a lot of that will bring that up. And then we always hire someone on a 90-day trial basis. Mm-hmm. So we'll hire that person as an independent contractor. They'll work for us for 90 days. And at the end, we both know that they might say, no, this job's not for me. Or we'll get to the end and we'll say, no, this job's not for you. Let's wrap things up. But most of the times, because of our interview onboarding process, most people stay. Probably 95% of the time, we've found someone.
The ones you bring in are there. And then what about ongoing training and upskilling? Is there a rough matrix? Obviously, you talk about the developments in AI. How do you keep your team and juggle training everyone while making sure that they, obviously business in a lot of ways is kind of like a race. So how do you juggle the R&D with the staying on top of things?
Yeah, I mean, we're not a fast growing company as far as hiring. We have about 25 employees. We keep things small and tight. Everyone is exceptional at what they do. They're using their own unique abilities, what they're great at, what they love to do. So that makes it a little easier. We do have an HR manager. That's her role, is to overall to manage all of that, our employee benefits, the hiring process, the onboarding process, but also on the HR side of things, like how happy are people at work? And so she's constantly doing these employee surveys. They're anonymous, so people can share everything, what's working, what's not working, changes they would recommend and everything. And she'll take that whole survey. She'll put all that into AI and say, hey, what are the top 5 common themes here? And it will put together that. And last time she did it, said, here's the top 5 common themes. Would you like another 5 that come up? And the second 5. And so it was amazing. And then I do a state of the company every quarter where I'll get on that and I'll just say, I got the results of the employee survey. Of course, it's all anonymous, but the overall, most people, the biggest concern was this. And I would share what that was. So here's how we're going to address that. So making sure that employees feel heard, making sure that we were honoring their requests, or at least speaking to it. And it's been really helpful.
Yeah, that's very powerful. Because all the companies is a group of people who solve the problem of another group of people, and they do it via a product or service.
Amen.
I don't really buy into the whole, they've been saying we're going to get replace humans forever. When we got mechanized farming, we wouldn't need farmers. When we figured out the calculator, we would need accountants. We got spreadsheets. We got QuickBooks. We're not going to need accountants and CPAs anymore. And none of that's come really true. And I think that AI, sure, it might be a difference, but I still think it's a tool. There's this video that blew my mind. I saw it probably about 2 years ago now. It was from a fertility clinic where the moment the sperm and the egg meet, there is a flash of light. And that blew my mind. You can see this. Yeah. You can look it up on YouTube. You can see it over and over anytime. When the sperm and the egg mix, there's a flash, sometimes multiple flashes of light. And that inspired me because I'm like, that means that there really is a spark inside of you. Like you really have a spark. Like, where does that saying come from? But before science proved it, there's a spark. And some say, oh, it's a release of zinc. Okay, you show me how to release zinc that creates sentient conscious life. Until we figure that out, right? I'm sticking with the spark. Like that just makes better sense to me. So that's that light inside you. And I think that it's just such a powerful way to think about it. And that now all this stuff is just tools. And great, you created a self-driving bus, but until the bus has a spark to drive it and help it decide where to go, it's still just a tool. It's still just a robot. It's
It's
still
still
a,
just a tool. I
yeah.
have a video on my screen right now that someone just told me about. I can't wait to watch it. I watched the beginning of it. It's these three high-level AI experts. The title is on YouTube. It's on the Diary of a CEO is the channel. Diary of a CEO, and it's AI Agents Emergency Debate. These jobs won't exist in 24 months. We must prepare for what's coming. So it's these three high-level scientists and programmers who really have this insight, probably beyond, way beyond me, talking about what they see in the future. Just like you're saying, it's fascinating. It's like, I can't wait to dig into it. I just watched the first 10 minutes of it. It's just my jaw was on the floor.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a bit of a bridge. There's the physical world and then there's the digital world. I think the
Yeah.
digital world, there's going to be more wealth made than maybe in the entire history because of all the opportunities that are going to be available. In the physical world, I think there's going to be more mechanization, more robotics, but I don't think it's going to change massively in the sense of you're still going to want to eat fresh food. You're still going to want to have a roof. Like the construction methods might change, all that sort of stuff. But it'll just all, and I guess if they're listening to this, they care my opinion because I'm like, who am I? But I don't see that changing too much. You're still going to want to travel. You're still going to want to live in nice places. You're still going to
You
want to
want
be safe.
experience, you want love, you want connection, you want that human connection, you want social connection, real social connection, not just digital. So I think that's where we're going to move towards. We're going to become more connected. We can become more connected and go back to that, the positive side of the tribe.
And I hope that. And I think that's part of why how we align these things is so important. And that's a great conversation to have. If you optimize something to be like DEI, it can, if you create a robot that's a chimpanzee seeking killing robot, it's just going to run nonstop. And then it'll wait dormant until something comes by to whack it. And so that's why how you align these things is really important. And also democratizing it in the sense of no one having an advantage over the other. You talk about how things feel like they're speeding up. I definitely feel it. It feels like it went from like a, oh, this is interesting to a stampede for everyone to implement
No
it
kidding.
because of the impact it can have. But the other side of the sword is whatever it can do for me, it can do for you. And all of a sudden, I went to this conference. I went to this Asia CEO conference. And when it was done, right next door, there was this AI conference. And I walked the vendor hall. I didn't have a pass. I didn't go in any of the rooms. But I didn't think the vendors would mind if I stopped by their booth. And I what I realized was that everybody was at ground zero. Now, this is when ChatGPT first came out, but Google had a booth there, all these banks had a booth there, and they were all there. And it was like they were just announcing this new product they're working on. No one was there to talk about the thing they've been selling the last 20 years. They're all about the new thing they're working on. And I realized that
It's
everyone just,
amazing.
it was like a reset button. And now potentially they might have had a moat that this big company had to keep you competitive and you couldn't penetrate it, you couldn't mess with them. But now with AI, some of this, oh, Google's got a team of 40 programmers that handle Gmail. Guess
Yeah.
what? Now this 16-year-old kid with a laptop and an internet connection can compete with them because he can code with no code tools to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And that's just
Hey, in the mid 90s, I was your age and I watched the internet give birth, if you will. And that was the same type of thing. All of a sudden, you're like, what's this WWW thing on all the billboards? And everyone's talking about this. And now it's just become part of our life.
So I'm excited, cautiously optimistic, but definitely optimistic. I think there'll be good and bad with all of it. So, Rich, what do you think is some of the best advice someone could keep in mind trying to move forward through this? Obviously, you said when you start a business, what about you? How do you want your life to look like? What about in terms of the market? When you talk about market dynamics when you guys choose to invest, do you have any insights? Because there's a lot of people that have, oh, I love pies. I want to build a pie store, but then they set up on the worst part of town to have a pie shop in. So, do you have any insights on that? Like, what would you recommend?
As far as deciding on what kind of business to build or what?
How to know where the money's going to be, how to know where the market's going, how to have that sort of insight.
I'm a big fan of the minimal viable product. So starting small, not overextending yourself, not going out and getting a massive loan to say this idea is going to be huge. And so it's start with something small, test your idea, test your concept. And if you can get a few sales, then you can start bootstrapping and building from there. And then once you got proof of concept, and that's when you can start doing the financing and everything. But I've seen so many people just think this is going to work. This is my vision. This is my dream. And they pour all their life savings into it and all that. And the sad thing is most small businesses don't make it. So I think it's a much better idea to just really start small. Like when we started Real Wealth, we were helping one person get their an investment property, and then it became two, and then it became five, and then it became 100, and then it became thousands. But it's like we didn't say we're going to open this company and hire 20 people and start selling thousands of investment properties. We would have failed.
I love that. You solve one problem for one person, and then you started figuring out how to do it at scale. Then you help the next person, then you'd help 10, 20, and you figured out how to do it at scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get profitable first, then scale.
I love that. I love that. I love that. Rich, this has been such a good interview. I've got a couple of pages of notes here. If people want to learn more, if they want to get in touch, what are some of the best places for them to connect?
The book behind me, Scaling Smart, is on Amazon and everywhere books are sold. So that's about how to design a self-managing business and build a business. But as far as reaching me, our website's easiest.
Realwealth.com. So check out realwealth.com. Go get a copy of Scaling Smart on Amazon and everywhere books are sold. Rich, is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
I would say, what is the most important thing to focus on as a business owner or real estate investor? And my answer is focused on you. Is, you know, all this business stuff. And it's like, you can get lost in it. You get lost in the goal setting and the money and all that. And it's like, when you really step back, and this comes from my years of coaching before we started Real Wealth, you really got to step back and say, who do I want to be? What's my identity? How I want to show up? How do I want to show up as a human? How do I want to show up as a spouse, as a parent, as a grandparent, where I am now? How do I want to take care of my health? All these things, it's gotta, especially for younger business people, it's easy to be so hungry and throw yourself way out of whack, but make sure that you're honoring the business side of your life, which I hope is also your purpose, but also put as much focus on the love part of your life. How are you honoring that? And how do you want to honor it? How do you want to show up? And then also your energy and your health and your fitness. Those are like the trifecta, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really important and really powerful. A lot of people don't even think about how they are the tip of the spear of all their ancestors. Like everyone that came before you lived, died, bled, cried, so you could be where you are today.
Yeah.
And if you would trade that just for a handful of dollars to buy some food, like maybe you're in a situation where that's where you're at, but is that showing the respect to that commitment, that gift that you've had? People, it's like we don't appreciate the air that we have because it's just always there. But I think that's a really powerful thing that you just brought up there, that, you know, all the people that came before you, all your ancestors, everybody that did everything they could so you could be here today. And I think about that when I drive down the street sometimes, all the people that spent weeks, months, potentially in the sun working to pave this road so I get where I'm going in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
They spent months of their life so I could be here today. Like we are the tip of the spear. And so I think that's a great piece of advice. How is it for you? Obviously, like now that you have grandkids, you do have a deeper perspective now. You've got such a long tail view in the sense of in the beginning, it was just about you and then maybe finding a mate. And then now you got a partner and now you got kids and it's now being a provider. And then you got staff and then supporting all them. But then also now your staff have families. Probably as you've come along.
Yeah, exactly. No,
your kids have kids.
Yeah, I think that's the cycle of life. It's like we go from success to significance. In those early years, I didn't even want to have kids because I thought it would get in my way of my goals of being a millionaire. It's like, this is my 25-year-old self.
Yeah.
And then I met Kathy and perspective change. And then having kids and seeing how amazing that is. And then having grandkids. So yeah, there's something in there about moving from that, the focus of just success to what's the significance of my life and the impact and what am I leaving behind or what's my impact? How am I helping people? How can I live an awesome life? And the way I see, that's why I feel my purpose is live an awesome life. And that's everything. It sounds selfish, but live an awesome life to me is be an amazing dad, be an amazing grandfather, be an amazing business person, being a leader, give back, be in great shape, be able to be surfing with my great grandchildren when I'm 90. So that's live an awesome life to me. And I feel like if everyone did that, it inspires everyone else to do the same. And it's good.
I love that. I couldn't agree with that so much more. I said to someone the other day, you have life goals and excuses. All I do is chase my goals. And they're like, don't you need rest? Don't you need rest is part of it too. They're like, yeah, but what about your kids? I'm like, one of my life goals is to be a good dad. But yeah,
There
you
you
know,
go.
but I don't have time to sit down and just have some beers. Like I don't drink, I don't smoke. I live like a monk these days because I got so serious about all of it. Cause like you said, but I really respect what you had to say. Rich,
It's a
thanks so
different
much.
high.
Oh yeah, it's a different high and it's a meaningful high. And it's
Yes.
Rich, thank you so much. For those listening, go check out realwealth.com. Go get a copy of Scaling Smart. You don't know what you don't know, and you can definitely trust Rich has got your back. I can speak to that. I can attest to it as
Thanks, man.
someone that's been around him for over 12 years at this point. Thank you so much for coming and sharing with us, Rich, knowing you got your own audience, your own direct reports, your own family, your grandkids, your own things to do. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience tonight so we could all
My
do and live a
pleasure,
little bit
truly.
better.
Thanks, Daryl. Appreciate you.